Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This episode of This Is Success is brought to you by Impact, transforming how enterprises grow revenue through partnerships. From Business Insider, this is Success. I'm Rich Filoni. 15 years ago, designer Alexander Wang was a rising star in the New York fashion world. At just 20 years old, he dropped out of Parsons School of Design to start his own label. Now, at 35, Wang has built that label into a global brand. He's shown more than 50 collections, including his most recent one at New York's Rockefeller Center in May. But for Wang, having ownership over his brand means thinking a lot about what happens off the runway.
I always really think about the business aspect tied into the creative decisions. You know, I always say to my team, you know, we as a brand and in our culture, we always try to apply creative thinking to business decisions and business acumen to kind of creative, you know, process.
Wang is the son of Taiwanese immigrants. He grew up in San Francisco, where his parents built a successful plastics manufacturing business.
I definitely come from a family that is very entrepreneurial in spirit, and I think I just always witnessed and watched my family, you know, be in, you know, in business together, but also how they thought about, you know, business and how they thought about creating a better life for their family. And I think inherently that must have just, you know, rubbed off on me.
And was it expected of their kids to go into the business as well?
You know, definitely there was the opportunity that my mom wanted to, you know, save, you know, the business that she created in California for, you know, either myself or my brother. And, you know, I told her very early on that it wasn't for me. You know, I was very, very early on determined to work in fashion. I wanted to work in fashion when I was very, very young. And I knew exactly that was what I wanted.
You knew that from being a kid?
You know, I remember my mom would like take me to hair salons when I was really young. And I'd always want to go with her shopping. And, you know, I remember like ripping out pages in magazines when I was waiting for her at the hair salon. And she'd be like, "Why are you like ripping out pages from a magazine and like, you know, taking them?" And this was when I was probably like 7, 8 years old. And I think just started kind of creating this personal desire and learning and educating myself on what this industry was all about and this idea of creating. And I think one thing led to another. You know, I started just kind of going into her closet, taking apart her clothes, which she wasn't very happy about, and buying scraps of fabric, and started just, you know, putting things together and sewing on my own, teaching myself how to sew. And I started working when I was 15 at a painting studio, like a ceramic painting studio. Because I came from boarding school, you know, I was very used to being independent and kind of traveling on my own and being on my own. So, you know, I signed up for all of these summer programs, both in London and Los Angeles, that I would just kind of go over the summer and take these fashion courses. But I knew very early on that I also, my end game was going to be end up in New York. You know, my goal was always to end up in New York. I knew that was where I had to be in order to really, you know, succeed in this industry. And I got into Parsons. I moved here, you know, over the summer. And immediately, like the summer that I moved here, I took on a retail job, an internship, and then started school. And so I kind of did all three at the same time because I was just so excited and ambitious to kind of just get my hands dirty.
It was after sophomore year when you decided to drop out.
Yeah.
How did you decide that?
So I was interning at Teen Vogue at the time, and which was my second internship. My first internship was at Marc Jacobs, which was a dream come true for me, you know, coming into New York being 18 years old. And I remember Teen Vogue was just getting started at the time, and so they were sharing a lot of the same resources as Vogue, you know, stylists and editors, et cetera. And I had, my job was to really call in all the clothes for the shoots. And the editors, of course, you know, they at Vogue, they expect to get what they want, you know, at any time of the day. And a lot of the brands, the more kind of designer brands that they were used to working with, weren't willing to send clothes for the Teen Vogue magazine because they felt like because of price point, because of the audience, it wasn't right. So there was this big kind of discrepancy between what image the magazine wanted to portray and what the brands felt like was appropriate. And I just remember at the time I went to my editor and I said, you know, like, what do you think if I like created this? You know, I feel like there's an opportunity in kind of very, you know, design-led, integrity-driven product that, you know, is at a more accessible price point. And she set me up with, or introduced me to, I'm sorry, a showroom that she said, you know, you should go speak to the showroom. Maybe they can kind of help, you know, kind of walk you through a bit of your ideas. So I went to this showroom and I kind of talked to them about this idea that I had in starting my own line and kind of what segment and category I wanted to go into and price point. And they were very interested in the idea. And they said, okay, why don't you take the summer and go create some samples and come back in the fall and, you know, we could maybe work something out, you know. So I was still enrolled in school at the time, you know, and I brought the idea to my mom and my family back in San Francisco. And I said, hey, there's this opportunity where the showroom essentially will do all my press and sales. And all I have to do essentially is create a collection. And so my mom definitely challenged me and kind of asked a lot of questions. But in the end, you know, she was always very supportive of anything that I wanted to do and that I felt that I was determined and passionate about. When I have my mindset on something, it's very hard for me to derail or go somewhere else. I always come back to a certain idea. So she allowed me to leave school. And I felt, you know, I presented the pros and cons to her and I said, you know, the worst thing that I could lose out on is time. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I can always go back to school and sure. Versus this is an opportunity that I feel like I just need to explore. And so we had $10,000 that she, you know, lent me and that we started the business from that.
And so what, you're 20 years old at this point?
I'm 20 years old at this point. Yeah. And I, so I created the samples, went back to New York. The funny thing is, the showroom that, you know, was very interested in my idea, by fall, they told me that one of their brands that was already in their portfolio was essentially working on the same thing. That was kind of like the first big surprise and obstacle that I wasn't really preparing for. But my sister-in-law at the time was also in between jobs and had offered to help. And she, you know, she really kind of came in and was like, you know what, we'll figure this out. You know, we didn't have any mentor, no really anyone that we could lean on. You know, I don't come from a family that was from this industry. Mm-hmm. You know, I like the only contacts that I had were through my internships. And we found out about this trade show that was happening called Designers and Agents DNA. And we decided to just get a booth there and see, you know, selling the collection ourselves. Also, I shouldn't mention that, you know, we had called almost every showroom in the city up until this point. No one would pick up the phone. No one would take our call. And so we just kind of said, let's just do it ourselves. So,
and I would just imagine that, like, just thinking of this young kid and he's putting his name on something, I would imagine that a lot of people are like, who is Alexander Wang? Who is this kid? Like, why do I even need to be talking to him right now? Like, how did you deal with that?
I think good thing is I have a very short-term memory. You know what I mean? I just kind of, you know, I take it with a grain of salt. And, you know, there were so many people constantly saying, like, you have no idea what you're getting yourself into. You don't know what you're doing. I think in a certain way that prompted me and that encouraged me to want to prove them wrong, you know? And so, yeah, I just, you know, of course, there was many, many people kind of telling me, aside from the editor, that was really, you know, her name was Gloria Baum, and I want to mention that because she was very, very supportive.
She always supported
and
you.
So, yeah, we did it ourselves.
Do you remember the first time you saw someone maybe on the street wearing your clothes?
I do. It was one of our knitwear pieces, and it had an image of a girl smoking on the back, and that was kind of one of the first pieces that I saw someone.
Did it take off?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. It was, I actually wore the piece also, and I remember the first piece of press was someone photographed the back of my sweater. I was at some New York Fashion Week event, and it was in the New York Times, and someone photographed the back of it, and kind of, it wasn't even talking about the sweater, it was just talking about the scene of the party, you know, or this event or that I was at, but it was kind of like the big image was of me standing at the party in my back, and the picture of the sweater.
So I feel like a lot of people will know you because, I mean, you ended up becoming like a celebrity yourself. You became like one of the favorite designers of like big musicians, like whether it's Kanye or and like the Kardashians for celebrities and stuff. How did you get introduced into that world and become part of it?
Oh, God, I never really saw lines between creativity and people who are creative, people that I kind of, you know, I felt that I understood or that I wanted to learn from or that I was curious about. I always wanted to, you know, work with them, you know, and I think that's, you know, when you point out people like Kanye and, you know, whether it's him or Rihanna or whatever, I think it's the same thing. I think these silos of how musicians or designers or, you know, actors, you know, want to bracket themselves now, it's kind of irrelevant. Kanye has a clothing line, you know, Rihanna has a fragrance, has a clothing line. You know, I think those kind of elements of what kind of categorize you are maybe too traditional, you know, okay, or like, yeah, irrelevant, you know. So I was always very immensely curious about pop culture as well, you know, things that I think influence and impact, you know, a generation that I felt like I was very much in tune with, you know, and wanted to relate to. And so working with, you know, comedians and musicians and things on earlier campaigns and be able to tap into other conversations outside of just fashion was something that was always a big part of who we were as a brand and creating that community and that tribe of just people that we wanted to kind of, you know, be aligned with.
Yeah. So you were able to build a name for yourself, start getting these connections and projects. And then in 2012, Balenciaga approaches you and names you creative director. That stint lasted for 3 years. And I had read at that point that you were putting in like 12-hour days going back and forth between New York and Paris. What was life like at that time?
Oh, gosh.
It sounds stressful.
It was a really, I have to say, incredible but difficult period in my life. You know, I had never really thought about designing for another brand. I never thought about working for another luxury group. But when the opportunity came, you know, it was a really big one. And I knew that because I was always very, very, I very much respected the house and Caring Group that owns the house. And I thought, oh, you know, they're interested in investing in the brand. They're interested in me designing for this incredible, you know, historic legacy. And I was like, I would be, let's hear them out, you know. And so I think hearing them out very quickly turned into me signing a contract in like 30 days. And I remember when Mr. Pinot told me the news in Paris, I was very, very shocked and I couldn't tell anyone. But of course, you know, I had to kind of consult my closest friends and, you know, they all were like, you know, that this is an incredible opportunity, go for it. I think I always knew deep down inside that it was like me going to kind of grad school, you know, because I never really finished school. I never really got to work for another company. I wanted to see how I would be able to operate on a much higher level with a brand that had a lot of other categories and, you know, had a bigger platform to be able to speak to the industry. And so in that sense, you know, it really allowed me to see at a much higher level, you know. But at the end of the day, you know, I think everyone acknowledges that as a creative, there's always a hierarchy of ideas. And, you know, do you give your best ideas to the brand that has the bigger platform and better resources or the one that you really own yourself? So it was always this kind of internal struggle of what,
where I
wanted to, you know, give my best output. And realized that, you know, I wanted to come back home and I wanted to, you know, give my all to the brand that I had ownership over, you know, that I felt like the ideas and the success of those ideas I would have ownership over.
It was just too much. You couldn't give your full self to either. You were being like torn apart.
Yeah,
from
I mean, you know, I was traveling again, you know, like 2 weeks every month, you know, so I would leave. I didn't get an apartment in Paris on purpose. I always stayed in hotels. So like I would fly red eye Sunday night, arrive in Paris, you know, 8 a.m., go back to the hotel, change, get to work at like 9:30, work all day until like 9 p.m. till like all week till like Friday, and then take the red eye back to New York and spend the weekend in New York.
It was like that for 3 years?
Yeah. Yeah. So
were you just like exhausted?
I just got to the point where I was just in meetings and I was just like, I felt like I was just pushing, you know what I mean? And I wasn't even really able to kind of have brain space to think about, because I was literally like, I would have meetings, no joke, every 30 minutes. I remember I would sit in a room in Paris and it would just be like teams coming in, like rolling rack out, rolling rack in. Okay, boards in, boards out. And it was just like, it almost like at a certain point, your eyes and your thought process gets numbed, you know. So it was a very mutual decision to talk to Mr. Pinot and realize, you know, he knew as well that when, you know, I didn't kind of offer the brand for him to invest in, that I wasn't locked in, you know, for the end game, you
so
know.
They would have a stake in the Alexander Wang.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's usual how the strategic luxury houses, they if they put you in a house, they want to know that you're there to really kind of grow that house for the long term, you know. Like, my brand was at a certain level where I wasn't going to shut down my brand, you know. And it was a brand that I grew from the ground up. We're coming up on our 15-year anniversary, and I think we're very lucky to even have been in business for 15 years. But, you know, the industry is changing drastically, and I'm always thinking about who is our consumer versus just designing fashion, you know, and thinking about, you know, the greatest brands that have always inspired me. When you think about Ralph or Calvin or, you know, these incredible American lifestyle brands, what does that new generation look like coming out of America? You know what I mean?
After the break, Alexander Wang returns full-time to his own brand, and he makes himself CEO. Stay with us.
Next up, Impact CEO David Yovano reveals the secret to enterprise revenue growth in 2019.
The trend in today's consumer behavior has created a crisis for traditional sales and marketing techniques. Buyers just don't trust salespeople or advertising today. This trend is causing enterprises to turn to partnerships as the next major channel for revenue growth. Partnerships today include influencers, apps, business-to-business partnerships, and traditional affiliates. With all these new emerging partnership types, it's just not scalable to discover, engage, and optimize them all manually. That's where Impact's Partnership Cloud comes in. Our software automates every step of the partnership process for over 1,000 enterprise brands, from discovering new partners to the tracking and attribution of the value of every transaction. It even takes care of fraud protection and payment processing, and it gets results. Impact's most mature clients are driving more than 25% of their total revenue through partnerships and growing this new channel by more than 50%. Here's the bottom line. Partnerships enable enterprises to grow their overall revenue 2 times faster than their peers. To find out how Impact's Partnership Cloud can grow your revenue, visit impact.com/businessinsider.
We're back. In 2015, Alexander Wang dedicated himself full-time to his own fashion label, and he decided he would be his own CEO.
And to be really honest, it wasn't that I wanted to be CEO. It was that me and my family decided that I needed to kind of take control over the entire brand for a period of time where I could really understand all the ins and outs and the kind of the weaknesses as well as the strengths of the whole operational system of the brand, so that as we were entertaining offers for investors to come in, I should preface it by saying that my family was always very supportive, in the sense that when the time is right and we feel like we want to invite in outside expertise,
because it was a family business.
Yes, it was a family business. The family was more than willing to take a step back, but they wanted to make sure that I really understood what the infrastructure was like, so that when we're looking at or having these conversations with investors, we knew what we would be looking for. I felt like I needed to really understand the business as a whole and not just like, okay, like, you know, this is what we do in design, this is what we do in marketing, you know, but really the whole scale of what the business meant on a global level.
So, yeah, so you were saying that like Balenciaga was like grad school. So basically being CEO, that was kind of like business school.
Yeah. CEO was like business school. Yeah. It was hard. I mean, I have to say, you know, it was a hard year. And I will also preface this by saying, when I took the role of CEO, I had already started the search for a CEO. I wanted to take that time as I was learning to be able to find, you know, in interviews and as I'm kind of meeting with, you know, other candidates, being able to kind of ask them questions that were like fresh in my mind that I was learning. So yeah, that was a short-lived, but a very educational and informative time of my career, but difficult for sure.
I mean, how do you know how to balance like your time and your energy into the business side of things with the creative side of things? How do you figure that out?
You know, it's funny you ask that, because I was thinking about this, and I don't know if it's just being Chinese, not to say that, but like, I always really think about the business aspect tied into the creative decisions. You know, I always say to my team, you know, we as a brand and in our culture, we always try to apply creative thinking to business decisions and business acumen to kind of creative, you know, process. And I really flip that back and forth in every project that I work on. You know, I think about the big picture. You know, when I work on a collaboration or I work on, you know, any kind of partnership, I'm always thinking, okay, what is the end objective? You know, what are we trying to create? What's the concept? Who's the customer profile? What's the price point? What's the distribution model? Yeah. You know what I mean? I'm not just being like, okay, I'm going to design this t-shirt and then I'm going to give it to them and then like have them figure it out. That's never been the way that I work. And I think that was probably also one of the reasons why my time in Paris was difficult, because in those kind of structures, you are put a bit into a box, you know, where I was not used to being in a box. I was very much used to being part of the whole conversation.
Could you give maybe an example of, here's a project that you're considering or starting, and it's like that business and creative side, are they're just linked. You can't even separate them.
So I've been wanting to do underwear for a very long time. And, you know, I've talked at length in many different partners and internally and how we could really kind of tap into this category. And, you know, it was a category that's very much owned by some very large companies and brands, but it hasn't been disrupted in a very long time. You know, when you think about Victoria's Secret owning, you know, that kind of the sexier, more lingerie kind of category, and Calvin Klein owning the kind of the sportier, you know, logo driven kind of. So I knew that if I was to sign a licensee deal, that I wasn't going to be about going into, you know, a wholesale distribution model that was essentially in the U.S. not really, you know, having a big light at the end of the tunnel. So I was thinking like, okay, well, it needs to be a new, you know, a new conversation, a new concept. And I thought about, you know, who are the players in this space. And I have a longstanding relationship with Mr. Yanai at Uniqlo. We collaborated essentially 11 years ago when I first came out. He's the owner of Fast Retailing. And I thought, well, they have this incredible proprietary innovation around heat tech and aerism. You know, they've never been able to apply that technology or innovation into
underwear. So it's their
underwear.
Material.
Yes, it's their material. Yeah. And I thought, well, why don't we marry that concept with this idea of innerwear, but in a way that can be worn, you know, all day, you know, to the gym, under layered underneath pieces on their own. And they love the idea. And so, you know, I was trying to take a category that I really had a lot of interest in and push it into a new conversation that, you know, was really innovating the dialogue around, you know, underwear. And it was a new distribution model for me. You know what I mean? Immediately, we would be put into over 1,000 doors. And I knew that the price point was going to be right.
Accessible.
You know, accessible. And it needed to be. And so, yeah, it's been a really kind of incredible collaboration so far.
Yeah, so it's like, I feel like you've gotten to a point now where you could kind of break the rules, like the so-called rules. I mean, even last year when you pulled out of Fashion Week. So to kind of get perspective on it, so it's February and September when almost all designers, right? That's
correct.
When they have
correct.
Their shows. And you weren't the first to do this, but you decided that you're going to go on your own schedule. What went behind that decision?
So part of this decision, again, it wasn't overnight, but we had talked a lot about how can we address the consumer better? How can we be more efficient with the consumer?
And to the industry
as
itself?
As opposed to the industry. And, you know, we were making a lot of direct-to-consumer shifts in how we were replatforming our website and shifting kind of the delivery model of our collection. And, you know, Fashion Week is always labeled a season, you know, fall, winter, spring, summer, 2020, et cetera, et cetera. And it's, I even always was confused about the seasonality, you know what I mean? Let alone a consumer who's watching now, you know, having the access, looking at fashion shows and then not having to wait, you know, 6 months before that product is sitting on the floor. And also the fact that, you know, we have a global brand and that, you know, spring, summer, fall, winter doesn't really resonate the same in New York as it does to Australia at the same time. You know, so we thought, well, let's take away the label of seasonality from our collections and let's just title it by the drops, the months that they're dropping. So this is our September delivery. This is our October delivery. This is our December, et cetera, et cetera. And really message it around cultural events or what's culturally going on around, you know, what are people shopping for in December? You know, they're shopping for gift giving, they're shopping for holiday. What are people shopping for in January? It's new year, new you. You know, they're kind of rebuilding their kind of self-esteem, you know, going back to the gym. And so building the product strategy around that kind of thinking and building the collection and the drop cadence around that as well. So everything kind of really leads from product, but restructuring how we sell the collection. You know, we are still a very heavily wholesale weighted company. So, you know, we can't really make that switch completely, but we felt that by taking away the idea of labels, you know, taking ourselves out of New York Fashion Week, being able to show the collection essentially during pre-collection market, how the industry knows it, we're able to get what people see on runway essentially 2 months earlier. We're able to just be a lot more kind of earlier in our deliveries. And so we're not shipping things as people are seeing, you know, sitting on the floor for 2 months before it goes on sale.
So, yeah, I would imagine like with that, you could have an advantage of being more consumer facing and tapping into like buying trends. But I feel like the risk there too would just be that even if you thought that like the Fashion Week, that's like a strange schedule, that's still when everyone is collected at the same time. So how do you weigh that risk?
Yeah. So thank you for bringing that up. I also feel that, you know, for the big part of fashion shows now, when you think about the ones that are really play on the big scale, you know, the Dior's, the Vuitton's, you know, they're most likely paying all of the celebrities to sit in the front row, flying the editors out to, you know, whatever exotic location to kind of participate and cover the show. But most everyone now, in terms of who, you know, consumers, the audience that just wants those, genuinely interested in the brand, they're looking at it online, you know, through social media. And so we realized that, you know, in order to have an event, let's not call it even a fashion show, it needs to be entertainment. You need to build content around it that people are not just watching models walking down the runway, because you can see that going to Vogue.com, you know? So when we made this shift, you know, we implemented like a whole host and live stream kind of element to our show. So it really became like a live entertainment, as well as kind of all the content that we would shoot around the show, like behind the scenes, backstage with the models while we have the talent there on set, so that it's a moment of, you know, entertainment, you know? And fashion shows aren't really about the clothes anymore. So it's about the brand exercising their message around what they want to say with this community and this kind of around the content.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's like another thing that you do that would be unorthodox. So like by the time that our audience sees or listens to this, you're going to have your show at Rockefeller Center.
Yeah.
And no one has ever done that before. And that reminds me too, like when you had a show in Bushwick, Brooklyn, like that hadn't been done before. And I'd seen some people were maybe mad that there was a lot of traffic. Some people couldn't get in. So it's like when you're taking risks to be different, how do you decide like, okay, this is something worth trying, or maybe people haven't done this for a reason?
Yeah. We as a brand have always wanted to push the boundaries in how we can move the conversation forward. You know, if everyone is just sitting around with status quo, then nothing's ever going to change, you know. And I think unless you challenge that, you know, there's always risks involved, you know. And I think, you know, we recognize that and we stomach it and we go with it. But, you know, I think that will always be a part of the brand. Of course, the editors were not happy that they got to see it second and that it was in Brooklyn. And I think we definitely, there was learnings from it, you know, in terms of operational efforts and logistics around traffic and do it better. And I think this time with, you know, Rockefeller, what's exciting is that there's never been a show where literally everyone is invited. We've done, you know, public shows where, you know, we invite like 150 people, you know, who go to our store first, get tickets. But this is like Rockefeller Plaza. You know, there's an invited portion for the industry, but essentially around the entire mezzanine, you know, anyone who's just hears about it,
for
wants
the public,
to come,
yeah.
can participate. And it's going to be really exciting because, yeah, there hasn't ever been a fashion show there. And it's such an iconic New York location. And this collection is really about giving back to New York and about kind of a tribute to American sportswear and all the pioneers that really kind of paved the way for me.
And so, like, even on that note, like when you're out doing things the way that you want to, and maybe some people will be critical of that. And I feel like in the fashion industry, from what I've seen, like it seems that people can be really vicious when things aren't going to like their expectations. So how do you even know who do you listen to? Like whose criticism matters or whose praise matters for that measure? Like how do you balance all of this?
The consumer. Yeah. I think at the end, you know, I feel that if the audience and the community and the consumer that I'm trying to speak to understands what I'm trying to do, you know, at times you're never going to be able to make everyone happy. But I think if you're able to address and learn from certain mistakes and be able to kind of provide better for the consumer, you know, and a lot of the times that they just want to be involved, they want to be included, they want to be heard, you know, and that's whether it's on product, it's whether on the experience, whether being, you know, included in the experience. I think that's the most important.
So you have to approach business from your audience's perspective.
The rest is just noise, you know, and I think there's definitely, you know, I don't want to bite the hand that feeds me, you know what I mean? Because I grew up in this industry and was very supportive, you know, a lot of the organizations and the, you know, the editors and the buyers, of course, you know, are very important to our business. But yeah, at the end of the day, I think for everyone's sake, it's the consumer who's shopping at those stores, who's reading those magazines, you know what I mean? They're the most important.
When I think of the industry, it kind of seems that success would be relevancy, because there are only like a handful of brands that have lasted like seemingly forever, and the rest, maybe they come and go.
Yeah.
So for you, how do you think of relevancy, and then how do you think of success? Are they tied together? Are they separate?
I do think they are tied together, but not necessarily under the same circumstances. And I say that in the sense that right now I'm much more interested in consumer than I am just fashion. And what the consumer wants from us as a brand sometimes isn't just apparel and clothes. You know, it could be other categories. Things in the wellness space, things in the entertainment space, such as, you know, festivals, you know, events, things like that. I think other ways where the brand kind of has resonance amongst a community is where I'm really interested in kind of moving into.
Is the way that you define success now, 15 years in, different from when you were just starting out?
Yes. Yes. There's a huge part of me. I just want to create beautiful things, you know, but I want to create beautiful things that really leave impact, you know, and create things that I think people really resonate with and that mean something. Building meaningful work and meaningful relationships is the most important thing for me. And I think that's one of the things that I've realized, and as I've matured, you know, become more clear in my head of what that, you know, equates to.
Well, thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to This Is Success from Business Insider. Our show is produced by Jennifer Siegel and Sarah Wyman. Dan Bobkoff is our executive producer. I'm Rich Filoni. If you're enjoying the show, please leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know which guest you've enjoyed and who you want to hear from next. We'll be back next month with a new episode of This Is Success. But before we go, I asked Alexander Wang for some fashion advice.
I think it's really about knowing your body type and kind of how to wear certain kinds of archetypes or materials that kind of exemplify your attitude and your sensibility.
This Is Success is a production of Insider Audio. This episode has been brought to you by Impact.